Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. An interesting mix for you this week, I think. I'll talk with two of the creative forces behind the upcoming West Coast premiere of Battle Hymns, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Lang's work that commemorates the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, to be staged at the Kezar Pavilion this weekend. Dancer Leah Stein brought her dance troupe from Philadelphia. She was involved in the 2009 production in Philadelphia. And I'll also be talking with her and Barbara Haru, executive director of Volti, just one of the Bay Area vocal groups that are involved in this 150-voice production, the others being the San Francisco Choral Society and the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir, the amassed forces being conducted by Robert Geary. The 56th San Francisco International Film Festival gets underway tonight with a gala opening at the Castro Theater. I'll talk with one of the programmers for the festival, Sean Uehara, who will offer an overview of this year's offerings. Also on the film front, with a new film version of The Great Gatsby forthcoming, starring Leonardo DiCaprio in the title role, critic Peter Robinson will take a look at the way F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic has in the past made it from the printed word to the big screen. Plus, a hot jazz band, Paris Combo, is swinging through these parts as part of a grand tour. They've got a concert here in San Francisco tomorrow, and musician David Lewis will be here to share some tales of the road, no doubt, and a track or two from their new CD. So stay with us. San Francisco will witness a truly unique musical spectacle this weekend as the 150th anniversary of the Civil War is commemorated in music and dance at the Kezar Pavilion, of all places. It's called Battle Hymns, and it's a collaboration between four performing arts groups, the San Francisco Choral Society, Volti, the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir, and the Philadelphia-based Leah Stein Dance Company, that last group being a co-commissioner of the work in 2009, along with the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia. Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Lang's score will be conducted by Robert Geary. Joining me in studio to talk about this major undertaking are two of the creative forces involved in bringing this work to the West Coast for its premiere on this coast, and only the second time the work has been performed anywhere. Leah Stein brought her eponymously named dance troupe here from Philadelphia, nine in number. Welcome, Leah, to KLW.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Barbara Haru, the executive director of the acclaimed San Francisco vocal group Volti, is also here. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, David.
So, Leah, your company is known for creating some site-specific collaborative dancers. Can you take us back to 2009 and the commissioning of this piece?
Sure. There's a festival in Philadelphia called Hidden City Festival, and it spotlights unusual locations throughout the city and invites artists to create installations or performances. So we were invited, myself and Alan Harler of the Mendelssohn Club, to be part of this festival, and we were interested in having a choral piece that where the singers could move, which was my interest. And it was Alan who suggested composer David Lang and contacted him, and then we began a conversation, the three of us, about what is possible, how are you interested first? That was the big one. And once David was on board, we began a conversation about a collaborative process.
And where was this first performed and realized?
It was performed at the 23rd Street Armory in Philadelphia. It's a very historic venue in Philadelphia because it's been in operation since 1774 as a military unit, and it continues to be active. So it was very interesting to be in this enormous, first of all, it was a very huge space, very ominous. There were Humvees at one end and these great, like, four-story wooden doors at the other end. Really a colossal building, but also it was occupied by military personnel.
Active military personnel. Interesting. So we actually have that field recording from the Army. We're going to hear just a little bit of David Lang's work, Battle Hymns, set to the text of Abraham Lincoln, "As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master." You'll hear some rather loud drumming, and again, this is from the Armory recording, so a field recording of just an excerpt of Battle Hymns, and then more with Barbara Haru and Leah Stein.
Thank you.
just a flavoring of David Lang's score to the text of Abraham Lincoln in that instance. We heard an excerpt from Battle Hymns. Leah Stein, dancers being brought into this massive work that'll be performed at the Kezar Pavilion. And Barbara Heroux, who is the executive director of Volti, is very much involved. Both of them join me in studio to talk about this collaboration. Barbara, no stranger to bringing new cutting-edge music to the ears of audiences, these 20 professional members of Volti will be one part of the equation that involves some other 130 singers or so for David Lang's Battle Hymns. Barbara, do the Volti singers have different roles to play and sing from the other choral ensembles that are involved?
Yes and no. The Volti singers, there are 20 professional singers in Volti, as you said, and they are sometimes they're mixed in with the singers of the San Francisco Choral Society, sort of as section leaders, sort of as, you know, the strongest voice in a pod of altos. We'll embed one of our altos. Not that the Choral Society singers are weak by any means. They're very good. But sometimes there are some solos. There's an extended tenor solo in the first movement that will be sung by David Kurtenbach. Four of the sopranos have some solo work here and there. So it's a mixture of solo and section leader and just being part of the army.
Mm-hmm. And the army, in this case, being assembled at Kezar Pavilion. Now, tell me a little bit about the challenge, just the logistical challenge, let alone the acoustic challenges involved in this space.
This has been quite a journey, bringing this piece to San Francisco. Bob Geary and I happened to be in Philadelphia in 2009 for a conference, and we saw the premiere in the Armory, and we both just were blown away by it and said, this is something we have to do. This is something Volti has to bring to the West Coast. It's fabulous. And it's taken us almost 4 years, but we've done it. We looked all over the place. We tried to find an armory-type space. We wanted that military vibe, but there just wasn't anything appropriate in San Francisco. There is that armory and the Mission, but the floor was so unconducive to dance that it was not a place we wanted to bring Leah's dancers in. So we finally hit upon Kezar Pavilion as it's the basketball arena, not the stadium. People keep saying, you're doing this outside at a football stadium? Are you crazy? No. It's the basketball, the roller derby arena. And we've really transformed it. It was amazing. We moved in on Saturday, covered the basketball court with plain gray mats, covered up the scoreboards with burlap, and just sort of made the space completely neutral. So it's just this big open space that could be an army barracks, it could be a parade ground, it could be a refugee camp, it could be an Ellis Island kind of place where people are coming through after being displaced by a war. It could be whatever your imagination takes you to.
Barbara, so talk to us a little bit more about what is going to happen during Battle Hymns. It's not necessarily a reenactment of a Civil War battle scene. It's more a meditation
no.
on war in some way.
That's right. There will be no actual gunfire. A little bit of drumming, but actually a lot of drumming, but no gunfire. What happens is Leah is reconceiving the piece for this new space and getting new visual ideas as she's in there and figuring out how to make it a whole new piece in some ways. Kezar has doors all around all four sides, and she's using all of them. So singers are coming in and coming down onto the floor in eight different lines and then forming up into a formation and then starting to sing, or running back up out those doors and leaving the floor to the dancers, or the kids are appearing in places that you're not expecting to see kids. You know, they're just sort of suddenly popping out of nowhere. It's going to be very visually interesting. It is not a choral concert by any means.
But David's score, won a Pulitzer for his score for The Little Match Girl Passion, one of the co-founders of New York's Bang on a Can Collective, and really is one of America's most performed composers right now in all sorts of fields, from orchestral, opera, chamber. So his music is integral to what's happening on this massive stage.
Absolutely.
Leah Stein, I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit of how that music is, how the dance is incorporated into the music.
Sure. Well, I'll just say it's just a real pleasure to work with David Lang, and his responsiveness and also his clarity and what his vision. And he created five sections, and he actually said that, you know, you can use these in any order. So he really gave a lot of license to me as the choreographer of what I, how this became a piece. I think my order was similar to his order in his mind. But we have worked a lot with the quality of the music that is just relentless. There's this sense of repetition and ongoing, especially the very first section where the singers enter, as Barbara just described, and they're upstage and they just slowly progress. And the music is also doing that, and there's not really a development and a build. It just is this feeling I feel is very connected to the relentlessness and the stamina needed in war, where you just don't stop. You just have to keep going. So choreographically, I was interested in that, especially for the singers. They're dressed in more of a military uniform, and the dancers are dressed in more of a civilian soldier, people left behind. They have more of a human underneath the uniform appearance, and then the choreography for the dancers is much more raw and personal.
That's Leah Stein. Her dance company is involved in this Battle Hymns, which will be at the Kezar Pavilion coming up this weekend, a massive undertaking by several forces in, here in the Bay Area, as well as the Philadelphia-based Leah Stein Dance Company. Leah, in addition to some of the rather direct, loud drumming section that we heard earlier to text of Abraham Lincoln, where else are texts drawn for this work?
The first section of Father's Love is based on the famous Civil War letter written by a soldier named Sullivan Ballou. And David Lang took that letter, which is very complete in the emotions and the things he says about war and being a soldier and honor and pride and believing in his country, but sad about what's happening. It's a beautiful letter, and it says it all in a way. And David Lang took the letter and divided it into small sentence fragments, and then he alphabetized those fragments. So the result is the singers never repeat a word. They just sing this litany, this list of sentence fragments from that letter. The result is that my experience is that the emotion, the complexity of the emotions that are conveyed in that letter come through, and it's the personal and it's the big, you know, the larger collective experience. And it's just a beautiful, powerful translation of something so specific and personal into this other structure that was very inspiring for me choreographically, actually, in addition to the music. Well, the music follows those sentence lines, so a father's love and never having eaten. So the music goes to the length of the words. And it was interesting because I began that section before I got music from David, because it took a while. Just I had things in my mind about military and place and history, and I just felt this sense to do an accumulation with the dancers, 1, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, in movement.
Right. There's a very meditative section that we're going to hear now. As we hear a little bit of that music, tell what we would see visually with your dancers.
Sure.
And in addition, the other choir members are also part of the choreography, I believe.
Throughout the piece, they are. And this is the final section of the piece where I think the performers and the audience as well feels that they've really been through something. It reached a peak. And at this point, it's a moment when all the performers are moving in the space. The singers are no longer in a formation, and they're wandering through very slowly, the dancers as well. And it's a little bit about the feeling of being in the battlefield at the end. But there's a sense too, though, it's called Beautiful Dreamer, based on the words of Stephen Foster, of just this other dream world, or people are like ghosts, people are have died, people are still coming into the world.
Music of David Lang. Written into the score, you'll hear the singers' aspirations with loud breaths in and out as they run out of air holding these long notes. from the live 2009 recording of Pulitzer Prize winning composer David Lang's piece Battle Hymns. It will be performed in its entirety this weekend at the Kezar Pavilion. Leah Stein's choreography will be enacted not only by her company, but by some assembled choral masses, including the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir. Now, Barbara Haru joins me as well in studio. Barbara, I understand that in the original premiere, there was no children's choir involved. How did the children's choir become involved in Battle Hymns?
Well, our conductor, Bob Geary, conducts not only Volte and the San Francisco Choral Society, which is a large community chorus, but he also founded and still runs the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choirs. So he has basically three choirs that he runs in his life. And when we started talking about this project, Bob just got the idea, wouldn't it be cool to have the kids involved? I think it started with the movement that's called I'll Be a Soldier, because that sort of seems like, you know, young kids playing soldier, you know, I'll be a fireman when I grow up, I'll be a soldier, so he's using the children's voices to start out, I'll be a soldier. And then we move into this whole meditation on war and what happens to those children when they become soldiers. So and it also adds a different texture, vocally, musically, that is sort of that lighter texture of children's voices as well as the mixed choir voices.
Well, you're in the final dress rehearsal phase of this massive undertaking at Kezar Pavilion involving over 150 singers, the dancers of the Leah Stein Dance Company, and the choral forces, as you mentioned, including the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir. It must be quite a production to try to rein in.
It's pretty amazing. There were a lot of people there. Yesterday was the first time. What day is it? It is Monday as we're talking. Sunday was the first time we had everybody there, all the singers and the dancers, in the space. And it really went very well. I think everybody suddenly understood what we were doing. We've been rehearsing in church basements and school gymnasiums and Leah has kept telling us, just wait till we're in the space. Just wait till we're in the space. And we're finally in the space. And I think people all went, oh, this is what it's going to be like. Okay.
Well, Barbara Haru and Leah Stein, I thank you so much for taking a little bit of time for talking about this incredible piece. It's being called the must-see arts event of the year. So it should be quite a production.
Thank you, David.
Thank you so much.
Philadelphia's Broad Street Review commented that Battle Hymns deals with all the turbulent, conflicting emotions that war arouses and is a, quote, remarkable response to war that merits comparison with Britain's War Requiem and the writings of Orwell and Hemingway. Once again, Battle Hymns by David Lang with the Volte Choral Ensemble, the San Francisco Choral Society, in joint production with Philadelphia-based Leah Stein Dance Company and the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir this weekend at the Kezar Pavilion. Information at several websites, including sfchoral.org. This evening with a gala opening at the Castro Theater, party to follow. Over the next 15 days, the festival, now in its 56th season, will be screening some 158 films from 51 countries. There'll be over 67 narrative features, 28 documentary features, 63 shorts, an international premiere, 5 North American premieres, 3 U.S. premieres. Some 25 women directors will be represented, and 31 languages will be represented. And they'll be in venues throughout the city and in Berkeley. I'm pleased to welcome Sean Uehara, who is one of the programmers for the festival. Sean, welcome to KLW.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I shared some of the extraordinary numbers involved in this year's festival, but would you give us just a brief overview of what to expect? I mean, there's so much. A festival of this magnitude. Let's back up and talk about your role as programmer. Mm-hmm. How do you select what becomes eventually screened in such a large festival?
Well, I'm not the only one who works on the festival. I'm part of a team. And we get films in pretty much every way you can imagine. A lot of people send us their works. We have an entries process. We go to other festivals around the world, and we track things that we know about through the trades, through the magazines, and also just through contacts that we have in different parts of the world as well. So Really, any way that you think a movie might end up in my hands is probably happened.
So how many programmers are involved in the festival?
There are three full-time programmers at the festival, and then we have a Golden Gate Awards manager. We have a few competitions going on at the festival. And then we have other people within the organization who help to gather information for us. And then we have consultants, a few consultants that are placed in different parts of the world.
So it's really a full-time job just watching films to see what's going to eventually end up in a festival, I imagine. It takes a lot of time.
It is a full-time job. And, you know, I would agree with people who generally people say to me, that sounds like a dream, you know, watching movies for a living. And it is, in some ways, I'm very privileged to be able to do it. But I watch movies pretty constantly, and not all of them are great.
Well, I was going to say, how does that selection process happen? You said there are multiple programmers, but do you have a meeting once a week to say, here's garbage, here's something for consideration, go on to a second subsequent round, or how are things eliminated?
It sounds like you've actually been to our meetings. That's basically what happens. And we have a number of pre-screeners that help us to watch films. Every film we try to get watched at least twice by two different people. And We just talk about what's out there, what kinds of trends we see, what we think is good, and you know, we try to shape something that will show the diversity and depth of what's going on in world cinema.
I was going to say, you must have some sort of categorization as well. You can't have, we've got 8 axe murder films at this point. We've got to get something. We've got to get some children. We've got to get animals.
Yeah. Axe murder films are not necessarily at the top of our list for what we're going to show. We do have some horror films. We look at different kinds of things, like about form, genre, area of the world, original language, whether or not a filmmaker is established or up and coming. And we try to get a mix. And like you're saying, we don't want to be too overloaded, but at the same time, in a certain kind of a movie. But still, you know, if something's great, we're going to try to show it.
Sure. Now, several of the films have Bay Area connections. Mm-hmm. Which are those?
Well, we have a lot of films that are produced in the Bay Area. And part of what the Film Society does, that's the umbrella organization that puts on the festival, the San Francisco Film Society. Part of our mission is to support local filmmaking. And so we have part of our guide that is titled Cinema by the Bay. And there's probably about 20 films in there, including short films. Some of the more high-profile works would be something like No More Road Trips, which is in the title. There's actually a question mark at the end of that, so I guess I should be saying No More Road Trips.
Well, let's talk about that film for a moment. It's by Rick Pellinger, who is mm-hmm. local, and I understand it's kind of a work in progress that involves quite a bit of audience participation. How mm-hmm. is the audience involved in this screening?
Yeah, well, Rick is he's really not only a Bay Area, but he's a national treasure. He is a founder of an archive, a film archive called the Prelinger Archives, which was taken over by the Library of Congress. What he does is he makes these films that are made entirely from found footage. And he has a number of films that are called Lost Landscapes, and they are based around cities. And he has developed these things where he'll show these films that are completely made with found footage, and he asks the audience to yell out, to talk about things that they recognize, to talk about experiences they've had with places depicted in the films. And it's really a lot of fun. This particular one, No More Road Trips, is of that format. And what the film is about is sort of the changing image of what it means to have a road trip culture in the United States. And Rick has a ton of footage from different eras that sort of show the rise and fall of the road trip. And now, you know, with the way the economy is and the price of fuel, the road trip is something that is quickly disappearing from American culture, and Rick's investigating that.
So we're seeing a lot of home movies as kind of spliced together of different road trips from coast to coast.
Home movies, but also industrial films, you know, films that are commercials for fast food restaurants or oil companies, or really there's anything is fair game for Rick. And he's very astute at picking out the things that are campy or fascinating and, you know, just mind blowing. Like it's hard to believe that somebody thought this way about what it meant to drive, you know, 30 years ago, that kind of thing.
So the audience participation providing the soundtrack, I'm trying to visualize and oralize how that's going to happen. Is it going to be organized chaos? Is there any organization to it? Is it people shout out what they see on the screen or what the dialogue is going to be in their own imagination?
It's a real social experiment. And what happens is that as the screening goes on, the audience kind of self-organizes. You know, people will shout things out. People will have discussions amongst themselves within the audience. There will be certain threads that are carried through. It's impossible to say exactly what's going to happen, but Rick has been doing this long enough that it is always fascinating and really a lot of fun.
No More Road Trips, or should we say No More Road Trips, with the question mark at the end, will be screening on Sunday, May 5th at the Castro Theater. Now, we mentioned briefly shorts. No festival is complete without delving into some shorts of some kind. Now, some 63 will be screened over 7 different programs. Mm-hmm. The selection process for the shorts must be absolutely overwhelming.
It is. We get so many entries. I'm not 100% sure how many, but it's definitely, you know, in the high hundreds, at least. And we employ a ton of screeners to help us out with that. And I think, you know, there's always some gems in the shorts program. And you really can't go wrong with attending one because, you know, even if there's happens to be a short that you don't like, it's over quite quickly, and there's going to be one that'll take its place that you'll love.
Now, in addition to tonight's opening night feature, there are a couple other special evenings you mentioned, including a centerpiece screening and, of course, closing night. What are those selections?
So our centerpiece screening that you mentioned is also a locally produced documentary. It's made by Jacob Kornbluth, and it focuses on the economist Robert Reich, who is also a professor at UC Berkeley. The film is titled Inequality for All, and it basically investigates the effects of the severe disparity of income inequality that's taking place within the U.S. currently, what its effects are not only on the economy, but also in terms of culture and society. Reich will be on hand for the screening, and there's a party, not necessarily to celebrate income inequality, but to discuss, you know, what's going on with that afterwards. Our opening night film has a Bay Area connection. It's by David Siegel and Scott McGeehee. Those are the directors, and they used to live in the Bay Area. They're beloved filmmakers. They made a film called What Maisie Knew, which is an adaptation of a Henry James novel, and it stars Alexander Skarsgård and Julianne Moore. Our closing night film is by director Richard Linklater. Many of you probably know him. Many of, when I say you, the people who are listening. And it's the third in a trilogy of Before movies. This one's called Before Midnight. It's the third installment that began with Before Sunset and Before Sunrise then. But it stars Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, and Julie Delpy and Richard Linklater will be on hand for that screening.
Great, great. All not an exaggeration to say something for everyone at this year's San Francisco International Film Festival.
Absolutely. I think that even if you have just a mild interest in film, there's definitely something there for everyone. And if you're not even really necessarily into film, you can come and check out some of our live and on stage programs. We have Mike Patton from the band Faith No More and Mr. Bungle will be performing an original score to a silent film at the Castro Theater. We have comedian Derek Waters and Natasha Leggero, who will be talking about Derek's produced series called A Drunk History series that's going to be premiering on Comedy Central in July. And we have Richard Linklater and Julie Delpy talking about their 20-year collaboration with their trilogy of Before films. So
all of those dates and times at the website sffs.org. Sean,
true.
Thanks for taking some time today to talking about the festival.
I really appreciate being here. Thank you.
That's Sean Uehara, one of the programmers for the San Francisco International Film Festival, now in its 56th season. Once again, information about all of the many screenings happening at sffs.org. Still to come here on Open Air, Peter Robinson is going to be on hand to talk about all things Gatsby. But first, a little escape to Paris.
sur les bancs de l'école. À l'époque, c'était colère-colle. Et puis les rustines et la colle. Mais là, je m'égare, je n'étais pas une enfant de cœur. On arrache aux instants rêveurs de naturel bien éthéré. Tu m'as vite envoûté. Cette étrange dictature. Mais là je m'égare, ton image apparaissant partout, même dans mes rêves les plus fous. Bien obligé de constater, tu m'as vite envoûté.
Vocals of Belle du Barry, part of Paris Combo, with lyrics written by Belle. Some very innocent-sounding lyrics in French, but actually a touch risque. It is in French, after all. They'll be in concert tomorrow evening at the Palace of Fine Arts here in San Francisco. One of the musicians of the group, David Lewis, joins me now in studio. David, welcome to KLW.
Thank you very much, David.
What a terrific sound that was.
Oh, thank you. That's a joy to hear it on the radio in the U.S., too.
Oh, good. I mentioned the slightly risque lyrics. It sounds so catchy and fun and friendly, but there are lyrics I want to share a little bit. Je te vois partout, or I see you everywhere, which began, it all started back in school. At first it was Winnie the Pooh, and then tire-mending glue, but I'm digressing a little.
Yes.
And then it concludes with depixelated, anamorphic, in HD format, I see you everywhere. What fun is that?
That's great. Well, that's, I guess, what's going on in the mind of Belle du Barry. And it's true, often people don't realize the music seems kind of catchy and fairly easygoing, and she's all these ideas are floating past. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how is the creation process happening for these tunes?
Well, in the beginning, we used to compose individually, and the group sound came more from the arrangements as a group. On this particular album, we decided that we would compose all the music together. So we'd go into a rehearsal studio with the whole group, and people would come up with ideas. We'd develop them together. And it was a longer process than arranging each other's tunes. But in the end, I think we sound even more like Paris Combo this way. And Belle then wrote lyrics. In fact, she wrote lyrics as we went along and developed them. So it's been fun. It's probably took us 2 years to develop the album.
Now, Belle Dubarry, a French woman, writing the lyrics for all of the tunes, or?
Yes, she wrote the lyrics for all the tunes.
Now, yeah. If radio listeners can tell that we're not talking to a Frenchman here, how did you, David, an Australian, get messed up with these crazy Frenchmen?
Well, I moved to France in 82. Originally, I thought I'd stay for 8 months and take trumpet lessons there, and I got into the conservatory there, and then one thing led to another, and 30 years later, here I am. I'm in France still, and it's been a wonderfully rich time musically. Paris is a great city for meeting all sorts of people, French and people from elsewhere that come to Paris like I have.
I've been a couple of times, and it is just an amazing city. It's a must. Yeah, I get excited every time I go there. It's just walking the streets. It's
yes,
just amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's amazing. Yeah.
Well, let's hear some more music, and then we'll talk some more. We're going to hear track 6 from this new CD. It's called Cinq, or Five.
Yeah, yep.
I kept calling it Five, and I thought, wait a minute, this is released in French. It's got to be Cinq, right?
Oh, well, actually, you can call it Five, because we wanted to give it a bilingual title, so a number seemed like a possible solution.
And this is Les Cailloux, like Les Cailloux Blancs, or the White Pebbles?
Les Cailloux Blancs, the White Pebbles,
Thank
yeah.
you, said it much more eloquently. What are we going to hear in these lyrics? Anything that we need to bleep out?
No, but it has a sort of a fairy tale aspect to it. It's a little bit like the, I think there's a fairy tale where there's a string of pebbles which are laid out in a forest to find the way back. But it's in the context of a more adult sort of love affair.
Music of Paris Combo in concert tomorrow night at the Palace of Fine Arts. The White Pebbles.
Est-ce que tu les vois?
Ayo, ayo, can you hear me calling? Can you see these white stones like pearls shining on my path? It's music of Paris Combo. My guest in studio, David Lewis, the trumpeter and keyboardist, I believe, with a few of those tracks on the CD.
That's right.
So the CD is called Cinq or Five, Paris Combo, a new CD. Tell us, is this what's going to be heard a lot on this tour? And when did the tour start?
The tour started on the 19th of April in Cleveland, and we're almost sort of halfway through the tour. People will hear six or seven of the songs from this album, and also songs from previous albums like Living Room and Attraction. Some of the people who have been following the group will be pleased to hear these songs as well.
Mm-hmm. It has an evocative nature to these tunes. It calls back to me like an earlier time in Paris. Is that where you drew your inspiration for the sound of the combo?
Originally, Bell, the singer, and Podzi, the guitarist, and François Tour, in fact, were performing music from the 30s, songs that were written at the time by, I guess, what you would call the pre-Piaf era. Some very famous chanteurs, and often they were performing with jazz musicians of the epoch, including Django Reinhardt. So I think that's, and that color has remained in our music, even though we went on to writing originals. Podzi's guitar playing is very imbued with the influence of Django Reinhardt and a lot of other things as well. And Bell's, I mean, she was in punk groups in France too, but at one point she was really very influenced by French singers of the 30s and also American singers like Billie Holiday. So there is, the past is there, yeah.
You mentioned the other members of the band. Let's give them a more proper introduction there. Belle Dubarry was lead vocalist for Paris Combo. Potsy, the one-named guitarist.
That's right.
thereby hangs a tale, no doubt.
Yes.
François Genin is doing drums, percussion, as well as other vocals. You're David Lewis doing trumpet and flugelhorn and piano on the CD. On the tour, which are you going back and forth between instruments? Are you?
I go back and forth. Occasionally I play piano while I'm playing the trumpet, which is more an arrangement tool. But yeah, I'm going back and forth quite a lot, and which means we can do versions which are fairly close to the album version. Yeah.
And I mentioned one other person, Emmanuel Chabi.
Emmanuel Chabi, who's the new member in the group. He joined us for this latest album, and he's experiencing his first American tour. We've been teasing him about it for the last 6 months because touring here is always quite tiring because of the transport and what have you, but he's bearing up very well. He's got a day off today, so.
So really a coast-to-coast tour in this continent. You've been in, around the world as well on this tour, or just is this a selection of
No, this is a particularly American tour, 12 dates. So San Francisco tomorrow, then Santa Monica at the Broad Center on Saturday, and then another date in the L.A. area.
And then we go Irvine on Sunday, actually, too. So
that's right, Irvine.
Busy weekend ahead.
Yes, yeah, busy weekend. And then we go over to the East Coast for New York, Reston, Virginia, Brooklyn, and then we finish in Boston, actually, before going back to France.
Very nice. And a little time off, I hope, or you got gigs lined up in Paris?
Actually, after that, we start doing quite a lot of gigs in Paris and in France over the summer. So we'll be kept busy.
It's David Lewis, trumpeter as well as keyboard artist with Paris Combo. If you like their music, go to pariscombo.com. There you can order this wonderful CD called Five. You can also learn more about where they're touring and find out some tickets for tomorrow's concert at the Palace of Fine Arts tomorrow evening at 8. And then Saturday they'll be in Santa Monica if you're listening online. Or tell your friends in Irvine that Sunday they can hear Paris Combo. One final cut before we say goodbye, David?
Yeah, this is Lux, which it means it's the Latin sense of lux, meaning light. In the show, we introduce it as a song about getting into the light, like a butterfly or a moth, but not too close to the light.
Music of Paris Combo.
Just
suis un papillon de nuit. Je me colle à mes amis pour trouver le bon faisceau de lumière qui colle à la peau. Oh, je prie.
Very fun lyrics of Belle du Barry for the track Lux. I want Lux. I'm not Robin Hood. I love the black light of wood. I want to be seen in the woods. Other lyrics, I'm not very bright, neither glowworm nor coleoptera. I just want to rub my backside in the light of a street lamp. Some great music of Paris Combo. If you like them, go to pariscombo.com or catch their concert tomorrow night at the Palace of Fine Arts and Saturday in Santa Monica. I believe that one's sold out. Pariscombo.com, or the tracks are available at iTunes.
Maybe I am right. Maybe I am wrong. When someone else makes love to you, don't blame me for feeling blue.
Different music indeed to introduce our next segment, all about Gatsby with Peter Robinson. Hey, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And I was just thinking in that Leon Redbone track, Maybe I'm Right, Maybe I'm Wrong, it's a story of unrequited love. And if I had to sum up Gatsby in one phrase, this is the story of unrequited love. It's a story of passion. It's a story of murder. It's almost a story of revenge. But I wonder, in 1924, when Scott Fitzgerald wrote The Great Gatsby, whether he envisaged the fact that there would be six movie versions made in the ensuing almost century. And it's ironic because he, in fact, died in 1940 as a scriptwriter in many ways a failed scriptwriter in Hollywood, and his last picture, The Last Tycoon, really in many ways says it all. So I thought with Gatsby opening next month, I'd take a quick glimpse at some of the classics that have been made talking about Gatsby in film form. One, which sounds an unusual casting, was Alan Ladd in 1949. It was a reasonably true production. Ironically, the one which first came out in 1926, which was a silent movie version, stayed close to the story. The version many viewers may have seen is the Robert Redford version, where Mia Farrow plays Daisy. And again, she was not exactly the Daisy Daisy of my reading of the book. The script originally written by Truman Capote got changed. He had actually cast Nick Carraway as gay. They brought in Francis Ford Coppola as the central storyteller and scriptwriter, and we then moved back to essentially a neutral storyteller in the place of Carraway. One version I liked particularly is a BBC 2000 version, and it's not a huge big-name cast, Toby Stevens, Paul Rudd, amongst the actors, but it certainly stays true to the story. It gets the music right. And this is a book about the jazz age. There are tunes in it, Ain't We Got Fun, other ones like The Sheik of Araby. So you're well and truly enveloped in the mid-1920s, the time of the flappers, time of politicians, criminals, game fixers. In fact, Scott Fitzgerald catches it all. And I think one quote from Fitzgerald really resonates with me. When asked about writing The Great Gatsby, he said, "I'm writing for the youth of his generation, the critics of the next, and the schoolmasters ever afterwards."
Interesting. All right.
And I think that's really true, because I find returning to the book at the crisp age of 72, I am getting more out of it than I ever did at the crisp young age of 18. And let me just finish with one quote. It's that green light looking across the bay at the house. And he finishes his story with, "So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past." And that to me is an incentive to read the book. Go to the movies, read the book, or listen to it as a recorded book, an audio book, and I recommend the Frank Muller reading on recorded books. Enjoy The Great Gatsby, but remember, start it as a reading exercise.
Indeed, and The Great Gatsby that's coming up next month does star Leonardo DiCaprio as Mr. Gatsby. Toby Maguire is also in the movie as Nick, and directed by Baz Luhrmann, so that should be quite a show. I mean, I don't know if you saw Moulin Rouge. If it's that's anything for the chorus, we should be in for quite a treat with The Great Gatsby coming up next month. Thanks, Peter. More on film with Peter Robinson.
Well, with that tune, I don't want to set the world on fire. I really have two thoughts. One is Gatsby, who in his own way did want to set the world on fire. And the other is a new movie, The Company You Keep, with Robert Redford, who plays the role of an aged weatherman. The weatherman goes back to the 70s, and that was the era when people were not just setting the world on fire, they were actually bombing buildings. Redford actually appeared, just for the sake of the record, as Gatsby in the early version. But this, to me, is a movie about the past. It's about how the past catches up with you. And as they say, the past is a foreign country, but just occasionally you can be catapulted into the present. The story is based on Neil Gordon's novel, and how these weather underground activists, as the title suggests, finally went underground and then started surfacing, having led relatively normal lives. And in the role of Jim Grant, the lawyer, Robert Redford has actually been playing a very civilian role as a respectable lawyer. And his sort of fellow fugitives from earlier days, Susan Sarandon is popping up in the story. Nick Nolte, hard to understand, but great to look at, and there he is. And then a real aging but beautiful Julie Christie launches onto the set. So for people who like nostalgia, they may say nostalgia isn't what it used to be, but this really took me back to the 1960s and 1970s. And while I may have protested against the war in Vietnam, I certainly drew the line at blowing up buildings. So this is a story which is a thriller. It's a chase story. There's a police manhunt. There's a whole area of self-retrospection. How do you come with a moral conscience and say, I did this and now I want to live a different life? But it's also a story about aging, because although Robert Redford is in good shape, as we move into the close-ups on his face, there is that wrinkle. He hasn't had any face work, and nor has Julie Christie. So they've still got the sharp, happy features. And there's a shade of All the President's Men. There's the shade of those midnight meetings in the garage, a kind of elicitation of information. But there's also a contrast, and I think the contrast is between today's journalism and the journalism of All the President's Men. Today, we're out there to sell newspapers. There's a certain cynical element to it. In those days, there seemed to be a moral purpose that you wanted to expose evil. I recommend this as a piece of history, as a piece of social movie going. It's just open. It's running in San Francisco, also in Marin. And the title, one more time, is The Company You Keep.
Well, thanks very much for that, Peter, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks, David.
Well, that's about it for Open Air for this week. Tomorrow evening on VoiceBox, host Chloe Veltman will be talking with Dr. Krzysztof Izdebski, the founder and chairman of the Pacific Voice and Speech Foundation. We'll be talking about the evolution of voice care as a branch of medicine and how the often overlapping network of laryngologists, speech pathologists, and singing voice specialists all play a role in ensuring that voice professionals operate at their highest level. VoiceBox tomorrow evening at 10. Sarah Cahill is your host Sunday evening for 2 hours of new and classical music for Then and Now from 8 to 10 Sunday evenings. And then Monday evening at 9, join me once again for Explorations in Music as we continue our journey of discovery of the life and music of Franz Schubert with the Alexander String Quartet and music historian Robert Greenberg. I'm David Lotulip. Thanks for listening.
Accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative.
No singer was more popular during World War II than Bing Crosby. This is Michael Lasser. Join me for Fascinating Rhythm, Bing Crosby, and World War II.
But I'll be seeing you.
You can catch the music of Der Bingel tomorrow evening on Fascinating Rhythm. Part of your musical evening that I mentioned also includes VoiceBox and concludes at 11 with Music from Other Minds. Tonight at 7, join us for Out in the Bay. Eric Jansen will be talking with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore. The provocative, agitated, angry, queer, anti-assimilationist writer is back to share her views from the end of San Francisco. Out in the Bay tonight at 7 with Eric Jansen. This is KLW San Francisco. The time is 2 o'clock.